Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The headlines this week have been dominated by the election, but one or two other related stories have been getting a lot of traction after the election of Donald Trump. He won when polls were all but unanimous in saying, that is, that he would not. And people have been questioning the media's role in the president-elect's surprising, even stunning victory. With me in studio to talk about it are Terry Jones, the founder's professor of political science and public policy administration at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Matt Carlson is associate professor of communication at St. Louis University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much.
NPR's David Folkenflik, who is the media critic for the network, has called this last election a major media failure in terms of what the polls, how the polls performed, and in media coverage. Terry Jones, do you agree with him?
Well, yes. The polls were off by a significant margin, not by a tremendous one. The polls thought Hillary Clinton, aggregating them, would win by 2 points or so, and of course she did not. The margin that ultimately occurred was much closer, so it underestimated Trump's support and overestimated slightly her support.
We'll come back and ask you why in just a moment, but Matt Carlson, let me get your take on this major media failure this election.
Yeah, I think there is a failure, but I think the question is what kind of failure is there? In some ways, there has been a lot of reporting about Donald Trump that people thought would undermine his candidacy. And the media critic Jack Schaefer wrote a column this week saying, yeah, these stories are there, but people didn't care, that they looked past them and they voted anyway. So that the failure wasn't that people didn't know about it, it's just that they stopped caring. And that's a really deeper question. And the question is, people, do they not see the press as legitimate? Are they so hardened in their views that they cannot be dissuaded? Are they so wedded to other news that gives them information they want that they can't come back to the center? So I think it's a much more complex failure than we can even start to realize at this early stage.
Well, we can get a little bit deeper into that in a moment, too. But let me go back to Terry and ask you why the polls were off.
First of all, it's going to take us anywhere from 3 to 9 months to answer that question completely, those of us who do this sort of thing. The American Association of Public Opinion Researchers, which is our trade group, our disciplinary body, is already formed a task force to look at it, and has several, all the people on it are very well qualified. I think there are going to be four things that they will look at. It could be any one of them or some combination. One is the so-called shy Trump vote, the number of individuals who, particularly possibly college-educated individuals, who were really for Trump but didn't want to say so to a live telephone interviewer, and therefore that might account for a couple of points. We need to account for the 4 or 5 points difference here. Second is the turnout. That's particularly important on a state-by-state basis. Let me use Missouri as an example. In 2012, if you take the presidential shares of the vote in that year, compare them to 2016, the big city like Kansas City and St. Louis voted less. The rural areas voted more. If you had not adjusted for that in your turnout model as you predicted the result, then that would have caused some error. And then the third-party vote turned out to be much less than it was in the polls towards the end. At that point, about 10% said they were going to vote either for Johnson or Stein. Turns out that's more like 5%. Well, where did those other 5% go? Did they go disproportionately towards Trump? And then finally, and more subtly, was some of the anti-establishment attitude among Trump supporters such that they were less likely to cooperate with the poll and to say, hell no, I'm in hang up.
Well, you know, what about these cell phones? We'd heard a lot about in previous election cycles that because of people who were using the cell phones and the way they're used, that you really couldn't get an accurate read on the public.
The national samples, almost all of them, used both landline and cell. So things like the CBS, New York Times poll, or the NBC Wall Street Journal are taking that into account, and about half of their sample comes from cell lines and the other from landlines. So that's not a factor in the national estimates. It can be a factor in the state-by-state estimates, and the polls were particularly wrong in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. And those were obviously very important states in the ultimate outcome.
What about the accuracy of the sample? I mean, having the demographics right.
Well, that's what I was referring to when I was talking about vote share. One of the demographic cards is the city of St. Louis going to be the same share of Missouri's vote in 2016 as it was in 2012, or the cities of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh within Pennsylvania. And those will be some of the things that will be investigated by the task force. What assumptions were the pollsters making, and were those assumptions ultimately justified by the data that we now know happened?
Matt, what is your take on this? Do you have some thoughts with regard to the way polls were used and evaluated?
Well, there's a lot of questions about, yes, the likely voter screen. And this is when a poll tries to figure out, okay, are you going to vote or not going to vote? And people generally say they're going to vote. It's socially acceptable to say, I'm going to vote, and not socially acceptable to say, I really don't care. But there's something even deeper here, which gets to how polls work. And I actually answered a poll. I was really excited when the pollster called, because I'm the one person that's excited when the pollster calls, because I teach about this. And, you know, I answered the questions, and they were pretty much, who are you voting for, and what's your opinion? And that's it. That's my role in the poll. And this really points to what polls are. You're given choices that are usually binary, that are pre-selected. And from that, it's really hard to extract things like how excited you are. Are you really, or why are you voting? Is it you're angry? Is it that you're scared of the way the country is going? And so the problem with polls in general is that they have to constrain the answers in order to be scientific. They have to limit what you can say. But in that limitation, we fail to pick up nuances. And I think this is an election where those nuances really mattered.
Terry, your reaction to that?
It's very appropriate. Indeed, predicting who's going to vote when only 60 to 70% of the registered voters turn out is one of the chancy things that you have to go through. And if you're wrong, even by a few percentage points, again, that can contribute to what was a damaging and error in terms of the misestimate of the Trump vote, but not a dramatically high one.
Has there been, aside from Dewey Truman, has there been another instance in presidential cycles in which the polls have been off to this degree?
No. And the Truman, that was a situation where it was a whole different world of polling. Then the polling stopped several weeks before the election, and so that there was nothing up to and close to Election Day itself.
And there were only a couple of polls. I think Gallup and somebody else was out there.
Well, there were also a bunch of academics from the University of Michigan polling for the first American National Election Studies. And when they got around to looking at their data a few days after the election, they said, oh, my God, we got it right.
The academics got it right.
Well,
right.
And they were using more advanced methodologies, which resulted in a revolution in how the polling industry operated.
Right. You know, the polls were wrong in 2012. They were just wrong, and Obama actually won by more than the polls suggested they win. And I think that polling error was interesting because I think it weighed on people's mind. And what it did is it allowed people to think that the Clinton voter turnout machine would be similar to the Barack Obama voter turnout machine, and that turned out not to be the case. So I think there was an assumption built in that maybe the polls were not picking up Clinton voters rather than not picking up Trump voters.
How about the newspaper, Matt, the newspaper's use of polls? I mean, it seemed like every major paper had its own poll going.
Well, newspapers want to have polls, and especially broadcast organizations, because polls look prestigious. You have your name out there, and you get to say the Washington Post poll. But, to understand the use of polls, we have to step back and say, how do we cover election campaigns? And a lot of it is what we call the horse race frame, the idea of what matters is who's ahead, who's behind, what's the strategy they're using. And when we do that, we don't really look at issues. We look at issues as a way of getting elected. The ultimate goal is getting elected or not. And so we lose track of you know, why we're voting for who we're voting for. And if you're going to have a horse race frame be the dominant way of talking about election, then polls are your data. They're what tells you how the horse race is. And, you know, a lot of us saw this if you were watching television early in the evening on Election Day. The assumption was that Hillary Clinton would win easily. And that really dictated what the coverage was like. And early in the evening, the coverage was about Trump losing. And Kellyanne Conway was on one of the cable channels, and she was already giving excuses for why they were going to lose. And then you see as the night goes on, that frame changes as the votes come in, and the end of the night is entirely different.
Terry, the polls really have changed the way the media cover these races.
Very much so. And the herd mentality that Matt refers to has been alive for a long time. There was a wonderful book on the 1972 elections called The Boys on the Bus and how they all got together to decide what the lead was going to be in their stories. That phenomenon extends to this day.
Let me just put this out there and get your reaction to it. We all are familiar with what's going on with newspapers today. They have diminished resources. And because so many of them are using polls, it seems to me that they're relying on the polls as the basis for their coverage, and they're not going out and really taking the pulse of the population. And that's why, a part of why, the big story was missed here, the fact that the angry America out there that no one really saw.
And if you look at the numbers, there are half as many newspaper reporters now than there were a decade ago. I mean, it's a lot diminished. And these are mostly at regional papers, at smaller papers in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Missouri, that have lost people. And then the other part of it, too, is we live in an era where we really fetishize data. We love big data. We love numbers. And so polls fit into this idea of, if we have all these numbers, we're able to see what's going on. So you lose the ears on the ground of talking to people and seeing what they're saying.
On the other hand, that's very old-fashioned, the old man on the street or the person mm-hmm. on the street interview, and that you self-select Don, who, and Don tells you how the Dons of this world feel, and you then assume that that's you can generalize that to everybody.
Are we likely to get a more accurate picture by aggregating these polls? If there are 20, 24, whatever the number of organizations out there collecting data are, by aggregating, as so many people did, do we get a better picture?
The answer has been yes, and then indeed the numbers that I quoted earlier in the broadcast were from the aggregations, mm-hmm. 538, which is the most notable of them, but also pollster.com, which is part of Huffington Post. So the answer definitely is yes, but even when you aggregate, there was a systematic error against Trump and slightly for Clinton.
Go ahead.
And if you look at 538, there certainly was a systematic error. 538 still said there was a 70% chance of Hillary Clinton being elected and a 30% chance of Donald Trump. And things that happen 30% of the time happen. I mean, there's a lot fewer elections, so it's very difficult because you have a small sample size. But if you look at a baseball player, if you get hit 30% of the time, you're a pretty good baseball player. Mm. And so I think that, we saw 70% as certainty. And that's not certainty.
Well, Nate Silver, who is 538, mm-hmm. has really taken his lumps. He's a victim of his own success in the past, but he missed it so badly today, they say that he may even be ruined by this.
I think that's an overreaction. And again, I think what Nate Silver has done, and people like Nate Silver, they're very critical of their own methodology. One of, his strengths is that instead of saying, no, it wasn't a mistake, or let me try to explain it away, it's we're going to study this. We're going to look at every last number, every way possible in order to get to the bottom of it.
Right. Going to have to take a break. We'll do that now. I'm talking with Terry Jones of the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and with Matt Carlson of St. Louis University. We're talking about media coverage, specifically the journalist's coverage and the pollsters' coverage of this most recent election. Back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd like to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Terry Jones and Matt Carlson. Terry, a lot of people may be confused by margins of error. Mm-hmm. Will you educate those who wonder exactly what that is and how that works?
The polling is based upon a law, the law of large numbers. It's like one of the laws of gravity, or Newton's laws. And it says that if you take an infinite number of samples from anything and measure anything in that sample, the shape of your results will take the form of a normal curve. That then enables you to trigger mathematics and probability mathematics to talk about how likely it is that what you found is or is not off the center of that normal curve.
If you take a sample then of let's say 400 people, and I think the margin of error is around 5-6%.
5%, plus or minus 5%. But you can only be 95% sure of that. Everything is a probability. Nothing is a certainty.
But does that have any value then as a poll? I mean, if you're talking about a 10% swing potentially.
Journalists, by and large, tend to misinterpret that margin of error if it's a cliff, and if you're outside it, it's, the race is decided one way or the other, and if you're inside it, it's too close to call. It's a normal curve. It's sloping down. It's not a rectangle.
How do you teach that, Matt?
First of all, with a blackboard, which is difficult to do.
It's difficult to teach because you're trying to teach people who are going to become, say, journalists and who are going to have to use these numbers. I mean, there's teaching the public, which is important, but there's also teaching the people who are going to be using these numbers and to use them correctly. And I think that's the more important issue, is to make sure that the journalists who are using these numbers and just throwing them out there have an understanding of what they're talking about and what these mean. I think that doesn't happen very often. We usually look at polls as facts, as the actual situation out there, as having a reality. But we have to understand that it's a probability. It's our best guess at telling something. And I think we have to look at how we use polls. I mean, what's more important a lot of times is how polls move over time, you know, which directions. That can indicate some sort of movement over time and opinion. But to say this is exactly what's going to happen, you know, it's the best we can try to do. But we have to recognize it's not the same as truth.
Let's take some calls. We have a number of people who want to get into this discussion. Let's bring them in. We'll start with Diana calling from St. Louis. Diana, go ahead. You're on the air.
Great. Good afternoon, Don.
Hi.
I just want to say that a lot of people do not trust the media, as you already stated, but they don't trust pollsters as well. They think that the media and pollsters are working hand in hand. And the gentleman was correct about having journalists who know how to not only read and interpret, but report the results of the polls. I've watched a lot of journalists, and I can just name names, starting with Nora O'Donnell with CBS, and the other one who works with Matt Lauer. They really look so biased and so for Hillary. Now, I was trained in communications that journalists are not supposed to really expose the person for whom they're voting. And so we don't want to know how the journalists feel or what they think. Just report the facts. And they really didn't do that this time. And that turned a lot of people off.
All right. Diana, thank you so much for the call. Do you think that's a part of the story?
Well, if you look at accusations of media bias, I mean, they've been around for 50 years. And in this election, I think they are more important than ever. Because what they do is they give you a way of discounting information. You can say, I don't believe what I heard because I think that person is biased. I think that the liberal bias claim is really overused. I think that there are biases in the media, but they're more about sensationalism, about horse race, about excitement than they are about having a liberal leaning. Now, polls get dragged into this because they put their names on the polls. It's the NBC poll. It's the Washington Post poll. And so they get associated with the same sort of negative feelings as the news organizations themselves. And I think this is something that we're going to have to really think about.
Polls are in the accuracy business, not the advocacy business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way they're supposed to be. But people tend to react to what they see on television and read, thinking that if they don't agree with what they're reading or seeing, then there's a bias. Mm-hmm. There's a bias involved there. What about the so-called fake news, fake journalism, Matt, in social media?
You know, a lot of attention right now is going to the idea of what Facebook should do. I mean, Facebook is the world's largest news distributor. That's a weird role for Facebook. Facebook did not set out to do that. But with 1.7 billion users around the world, there's a lot of news on Facebook. But Facebook has no journalists. It doesn't really have anybody looking at the journalism right now. And so what we see is these stories are circulating. There was one from a made-up paper called the Denver Guardian about how the FBI agent who had exposed Hillary's emails was dead in a murder-suicide. And it was entirely false. But here's the problem. That story circulated and got 1 million likes on Facebook, and the story debunking it on Snopes got 30,000.
And Terry, that can influence polls.
Yes, indeed it can. And indeed, what we saw in this election was a dramatic shift from the so-called traditional mass media to the social media as a form of communication.
Right. Let's take another call. Teddy will join us from St. Charles. Go ahead, Teddy. You're on the air. Are you there? Go ahead.
Yes, I am. I just wanted to say about the polling process, and this may pertain more locally than nationally, but we were just inundated, of course, as was everyone, with calls, and many of them computerized, but I felt they were always, always, the surveys, the questionnaires, far too long, far too disorganized. People lose patience. I think they hang up. I'm not sure what that does to the validity if you're halfway through and then you hang up and don't complete it. But it was frustrating and exasperating. And sometimes the way the questions are organized, they even felt manipulative. So I think people need to rethink how they're questioning people if they want people to respond and if they want the data to be valid.
Teddy, thank you for the call. Terry, there are pollsters and there are pollsters.
Yes, there are. But there's active discussion. And much what she said is very on point. Cooperation rates have gone down dramatically. When I first got into polling a long time ago, over half the people cooperated. If you reached them, they went through the questionnaire. Now we're down to 10 to 15%, usually sometimes 20%, depending on the topic and the closeness it has to the community in question.
Let's take another call. And Patricia's been waiting for a long time, so let's bring her in. She's in Wildwood. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hi, I haven't been waiting that long. Most people I know scoffed at the idea that Trump would win, even if they wanted him to win. But I spent a few days in northeast Missouri last week in a small town, and starting just past Hannibal, there were homemade signs saying things like, lock her up, Hillary's a criminal, and the anger and the hate was obvious in these signs. The gas stations I stopped at which I stopped, sold only Make America Great hats. The local newspaper in the small town I was visiting ran the results of a local high school and elementary students, an election poll, and Hillary hardly got any votes. And those were obviously the reflections of their parents. I just can't help thinking most people get their news, most older adults get their news from Fox News, as far as I can tell. And younger ones don't subscribe to any cable stations, and they get their news from Twitter or Facebook.
Right.
And I think the pollsters did not go to the rural areas where now we know people voted for Trump. And I think perhaps these people in those areas are overlooked, and maybe that's why they're angry. I'm a Hillary supporter. I can hardly pick myself up after this, incidentally. But I do think not paying attention to people outside of major cities was a major mistake.
Well, you visited the part of America that elected Donald Trump president. There's no question about it. And Terry, it comes back to your point of the so-called Bradley effect, that being the shy voter, the shy
Trump voter.
Yeah, not wanting to actually admit that they were. So that's what she's talking about.
That's part of it. But the rural-urban chasm is larger than it's ever been in not simply Missouri, but most of the United States. And so when you look at the numbers from Missouri, outstate, outside the major urban areas, and outside Columbia, Jefferson City, and Springfield, the Trump vote was over 70%. And in the other areas, it was under 40%. That's a big divide.
Yeah. And I think it's part of that is, you don't choose who you vote for just because you watch something on the news. We choose who we vote for because we're socialized, where we live, who's around us. And I think that as we become more polarized, we certainly are surrounded by more people that might think like us and fewer people that don't think like us. And that just makes us more polarized. We talk a lot about what's happening in media and social media and the polarization on cable news, but it's also in our communities, and we have to recognize that.
You know, she mentioned the cable networks, and it just brings to mind another criticism of the media, primarily the cable networks, but also the commercial networks. The fact that they gave Donald Trump so much free time, cable particularly egregious, but Les Moonves, who is the head CBS, said, put him on every chance you get. He's golden for us. A lot of money was generated by giving him all this free time.
It's all about eyeballs and ears.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of back to the bad publicity is still publicity. And I think that billions of dollars of free airtime is what they're talking about. But it helps you cut through the clutter. And I think one of the things that we see is there's so much distraction in modern life. There's so many different things pulling for our attention. It's so easy to find something to look at. And so you have to rise above distraction to get elected. And Donald Trump knew how to do that.
All right. Let's take another call. Time's beginning to get away, but we'll bring in Bob calling from Belleville. Go ahead, Bob.
I was called some months ago. And, you know, then they asked me reasons why I might be voting for Mr. Trump. And, oh, you know, it's a bunch of kind of cream puff type of questions. And I added that the only reason that I was really wanting a regime change was to get rid of the egregiously illegal Obama Justice Department, which had been blockading justice for the last 8 years, and I'd gotten turned on to this by reading J. Christian Adams' book.
All right, thank you for the call. Anybody want to respond to Bob?
I think this is just the country we live in now. I mean, I think it's a gross overstatement to say that the Justice Department is a criminal enterprise. Are there valid criticisms to be made of the Obama administration? Absolutely. Should we be talking about those criticisms? Absolutely. But if we turn it into they're a bunch of criminals, then there's not a lot to go from there. What do we build on when we can't even agree on that basic idea of legitimacy? And, you know, we have a media environment where you can find what you want. We talk about confirmation bias. You can easily find anything to support it. What people are searching today for, you know, the Russians must have clearly hacked the polling places because there's no way that Donald Trump could have won. And people want to believe that, and you can find lots of stories that will back it up. So it happens all over the place now.
You can also find lots of stories saying it would be impossible for the Russians to hack the process because they're state by state.
Absolutely.
One other thing I want to get to before we have to say goodbye is there is concern now as to how the media is going to cover Donald Trump. I mean, this relationship that developed during the course of the campaign was talk about toxicity, as the Washington U students have been finding out. There it was. Terry, you might want to weigh in on this.
Well, a long time ago, an author referred to the media as the fourth branch of government. And when you have government where the legislature and the presidency are in the hands of a single party, it's important that the media serve as a fourth branch, as another check and balance. So I think we're going to see a largely adversarial relationship between much of the media and not simply the Trump administration, but the Republican Congress.
And yet, Matt, when he went to Washington, Donald Trump went to Washington yesterday, he refused to take along that group of pool reporters that typically travels with him.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't given an interview to the press in months and months. And so the question's going to be, is he going to run a normal White House with daily press briefings and sort of the access that presidents give, which is always restricted but somewhat there? Or is this going to be something entirely different? And, you know, the press isn't very good at being adversarial in a lot of ways, sort of the mainstream press. They like things to be routine and to sort of follow the rules that have been followed. And then there's disagreement within that. But this could be something totally different. We don't know. I mean, I expect it will be somewhat normal. But at this point, just the fact that it might not be normal is really amazing.
Well, he is following a tradition I read this morning that he's giving 60 Minutes an interview, Leslie Stahl an interview Sunday night, the full hour with Donald Trump and his family. So that is following a precedent that was established early on. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. I wish we had time for more calls, but unfortunately we don't. Matt Carlson, great to see you again. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Terry Jones, always a pleasure seeing you. We value your expertise, my friend.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.